6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. The chief of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency says the triple suicide bombing at the Istanbul airport has the hallmarks of an Islamic State group. John Brennan warning that the terror group may try the same thing in the U.S.
I would be surprised that ISIL is not considering carrying out these attacks in the near abroad as well as the far abroad. And the United States, as we well know, is leading the coalition to try to destroy as much of this poison inside of Syria and Iraq as possible. So it would be surprising to me that ISIL is not trying to hit us, both in the region as well as in our homeland.
Meantime, Turkey's prime minister is already blaming the Islamic State group for Tuesday's deadly attack that killed 42 and injured more than 200 others. Dorian Jones has more on the story.
Flags across Turkey were at half-staff Wednesday as the country observed a day of mourning in the wake of Tuesday's triple suicide bombing attack at Istanbul's Atatürk International Airport. Within hours of the bombings, Atatürk Airport was reopened. Turkish security forces are now racing to identify the suicide bombers. The attackers appeared well-organized and coordinated. Prime Minister Binali Yildirim, speaking hours after the attack, pointed the finger at Islamic State. Dorian Jones, Istanbul.
Controversial Rodrigo Duterte was officially sworn in as the 16th president of the Philippines on Thursday in a low-key inauguration in the capital. Duterte has dramatically was sworn in to cleanse the country of criminals and crooks in his first 6 months in office. Though many citizens welcome the action, human rights activists around the world worry about the potential sweeps of arrest, killing, and human rights violations. The 71-year-old former prosecutor elected in May to a 6-year term in his first role in national politics. This is VOA News. U.S. President Barack Obama, Canadian President Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto are reaffirming their commitment to reject trade protectionism. The leaders met at the North American Leaders Summit in Ottawa on Wednesday.
The politics of trade are always difficult in every country. I don't know any country where there aren't going to be some folks who argue against trade. But we all believe that in an integrated global economy, the goal is not for us to try to shut ourselves off from the world, but rather to work together to raise standards around the world for workers and for the environment.
The United States, Canada, and Mexico account for almost 27% of the world's economic output. The Hague-based Permanent Court of Arbitration says it will rule on July 12th on a case filed by the Philippines against China's claim over the South China Sea. China has refused to participate in any hearings and says it will not comply with any decision by the tribunal. Six governments have conflicting territorial claims in the South China Sea: China, Vietnam, the Philippines, Taiwan, Malaysia. One day after the Zika funding failed in the U.S., lawmakers are hearing a sobering assessment of the virus potential to do harm. They also heard about America's lack of preparedness to fight the mosquito that carries the Zika virus. The deputy director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention noted that more than 500 pregnant women in the United States have contracted Zika, and the number is certain to rise. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, calling the international community to take greater action in tackling the refugee crisis. She spoke at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington on Wednesday.
At the end of 2015, more than 65 million people were displaced worldwide, over half of them children. That is the highest number on record since the UN's refugee agency started collecting statistics.
Power announced the U.S. plans to intensify resettlement of efforts to admit some 30,000 more refugees over the next 2 years. The U.S. has indicted six Honduran police officers for allegedly conspiring with the son of the former president, Porfirio Lobo, to smuggle cocaine into the United States. The police have not been taken into custody. They're accused of taking bribes from two undercover officers posing as Mexican drug lords. The Fabio Lobo, son of the former president, introduced the officers to the purported drug lords. I'm Michael Brown reporting in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi, and today is Thursday, June 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. The mandate of the United Nations mission in Liberia, UNMIL, ends today after 13 years in operation. This means that the complete security of the country will be turned over to the Liberian government. In Burundi's human rights record is under scrutiny at the United Nations Human Rights Council.
In the past 6 weeks, a number of members of the defunct Armed Forces of Burundi, or ex-FAB, have been murdered, possibly because of their Tutsi ethnicity.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zaid Rad Al Hussein. And Angola's Supreme Court ordered the conditional release of 17 political activists known as the Luanda Book Club.
It means the Supreme Court still has to hear their appeals. And it's also important to note that 16 have been released today, but one remains in jail. The youngest one of them, Nitu Alves.
Rafael Marquez de Moraes is an Angolan journalist and human rights activist based in the capital, Luanda. Those stories, plus Marco Wuma's sports, are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. The mandate of the United Nations mission in Liberia, UNMIL, ends today, June 30th. This means that the complete security of the country will be turned over to the Liberian government. Our reporter James Batty is in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, where I reached him to discuss the implications of the end to the UNMIL mandate and the reactions of the people in the country. Good morning, James. You're still in Liberia, specifically, I believe, in Monrovia. What are some of the news you're covering for us today?
Good morning, Jackson, and good morning, Africa. Today, June 30th, is the end of the United Nations mission in Liberia, also known as UNMIL mandate. This means that starting from today, all security functions of Liberia will now be turned over to Liberian security. The original mandate of UNMIL was established in 2003 by UN Security Council Resolution 1509. It has been adjusted on several occasions over the years to reflect security situation in the country, Liberia. The mandate calls for, among other things, the protection of the civilian population from threat of any physical violence.
Now, James, that's such a milestone. Do you think Liberians are ready for the task of taking responsibility for the national security?
Jackson, it depends on who you talk to. For example, Justice Minister Frederick Cheru told the local United Nations mission radio station here in the Liberian capital that Liberian security was prepared to assume security responsibilities from UNMIL. He cited the creation of security councils throughout Liberia that he said would together help monitor the security of the country. I had a chance also to visit the Center for the Exchange of Intellectual Opinions and the Forum for Democratic Reform. These are two of the places around the capital, Monrovia, where discussions are held on national issues almost on a daily basis. And here is a sample of their views.
I'm Joseph Chale. I work for the New Liberia newspaper. UNMIL has been here for a protracted period of time, and they did extremely well to restore peace. But I think it's about time. One thing you should realize is that they won't be here forever. They had a mission to accomplish, and from the United Nations resolution that brought them, they amended to expire by the 30. And I think it's just about time, you know, they take the courage and try to protect their country, demonstrate what they have learned over the years to protect the Liberian people.
My name is Viola Richards. I'm a member of CEO. The question goes to me if we are ready to accept the departure of UNMIL. I say no, because we don't have security. Not at all we have security. Because if we have security, there will be no armed robbery, there will be no raping, there will be no ritually all over the place. So I say no, UNMIL should remain until we are prepared.
My name is Oliver Wiese. We believe that Liberia has reached a stage where it has to resume responsibility of its own security because UNMIL has done extremely well to help us bring us where we are. And as we speak right now, we can freely say that with the level of understanding that we have gotten as a people, with the level of trust that we try to build among ourselves, we can sustain our own security. In fact, that will be one of the ways that we will prove to the world that indeed Liberia has come to a place of maturity. Liberia can now sustain its own security, because in fact, Liberia is a sovereign state.
Well, I'm Samuel Doan, and I'm a member of the Presbyterian Liberia. I'm also an elder of the Intellectual Center. Firstly, I want to say that our West African brothers did extremely well for Liberia. I want to say that the peace that they were fighting for is now mature. So I think it is time that it should leave. The sovereignty of this country, we need it back. And now we have gotten it back. I'm saying the presence of Omi here, if Omi is here and people are disappearing, what kind of security do we still want for them, that they should be on ground so that this will not happen? So it does not change anything. Is that Omi that taking our poor away, that making them disappear? It is ourselves, the government, the people of Liberia. So we can't tie this to Omi, that Omi leave will disappear. No. I'm here, who are disappearing.
Yeah, I'm Samuel, you know, Assistant Secretary General for the Exchange of Intellectual Opinions. And I think Liberia is ready to handle the affairs of our own security. Quite recently, according to the GPR report, which is the Global Peace Index report, it sees clearly that Liberia is more peaceful than Ghana, Ivory Coast, Nigeria, and even the great United States of America. Liberia ranks 72 out of 163 countries. And so I take into consideration where we were immediately after the war and where we are, looking at the strength of our security, and taking into consideration the number of army personnel on ground, and looking at how our security have been able to manage the security of the state, we think Liberia is prepared and ready to handle our own security.
My name is Joel Amma Hansford, a member of CEO and a Liberian as well. Whether Liberia is ready or not brings me to a question of what is a security in the first place. If we consider security to be men in arms, then we could say Liberia is probably ready. But if at all we consider security to be a whole subject, such as what kind of security are we talking about? If we are talking about economic security, then I can safely say Liberia is not ready to take on the mantle of authority, because when it comes to our economic security, there is still a major challenge. If we look in the faces of our ordinary Liberians, we will see a mass base of unemployment. There is no job. People are desperate. People are angry. And in the midst of desperation, people become vulnerable. And as a result of that vulnerability, they could take onto the street, and there could be all out of chaos.
My name is Alvin Wiese, and I'm a member of this institution, CEO, and also an activist. Firstly, if you have read about the Constitution of the Republic of Liberia, under Fundamental Rights, Chapter 3, Article 11, Section A, it talks about security of every Liberian. What Liberia is prepared? I say no. The issue is very simple. In Liberia, Omi drawdown is a very serious blow to our national political stability. Any country that is not prepared to uphold its fundamental security will not be prepared to uphold the fundamental pillars of democracy. So in the absence of functional security, there cannot be a viable democratic tendency, preachers, or practices. As the country goes to democratic elections come 2017, we need a vibrant security, very sophisticated, that will be respective of the citizen rights and the rights of protecting the lives and properties in the country. If you go in the rural counties in the Republic of Liberia, citizens are panicked because people are defecting from the army, they are deserting their posts, running away, escaping because of salary issues.
That was a sample of some of the views of Liberians on the handover of security responsibility from the United Nations mission in Liberia to Liberian security today on Thursday. The actual handover ceremony will take place tomorrow, Friday.
Thank you, James Buddy. James Buddy in Liberia, Monrovia. Thank you, James.
All right, Jackson. Bye now.
Angola's Supreme Court ordered the conditional release of 17 political activists known as the Luanda Book Club. The group was convicted last year of plotting to overthrow the government of President Eduardo dos Santos. 15 of the activists were arrested and detained after attending a meeting in Luanda in June 2015 to discuss a book about nonviolent resistance to repressive regimes by the U.S. political philosopher Gene Sharp. Rafael Marquez de Moraes is an Angolan journalist and human rights activist. He says that even though the group is happy to be out of jail, they are still worried for the youngest member who remains incarcerated.
These 17 activists are members of the now famous Luanda Book Club, who were taking seminars on nonviolence to organize protests against the president, and were arrested while studying at a bookstore. And that's why they became known as the Luanda Book Club. And some were convicted. Their sentences ranged from 2.5 years in prison to 8.5 years for the crime of reading theories on nonviolence. They were studying methods of resistance that have become quite known by Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, and other like-minded people.
And how long have they been in jail?
They've been in jail for a year. And the Supreme Court today decided to have them released.
What does it mean that they were released, conditional release?
It means the Supreme Court still has to hear their appeals. And it's also important to note that 16 have been released today, but one remains in jail. The youngest one of them, Nitu Alvish, he's in jail because additionally to his sentence, he was convicted to an extra 6 months in prison for calling the trial a kangaroo court. Right there in a summary trial and sentence, the judge locked him up for 6 more months.
So he basically called the trial a sham, and the judge decided to add another 6 months on his sentence.
Yes, exactly, just for saying that the trial was a sham. There is another activist, the 18th, who was on the witness stand, and he also said the trial was a sham and was convicted to 8 months in prison right there. And he's also serving his sentence at the moment.
It appears that the judge or the court, from what you're saying, was often keen to pass judgment or to sentence anybody who protested against the legality of the court itself or the proceedings themselves.
For saying one word the judge doesn't like, it's a very abusive court system. Has no regards for the laws it is supposed to uphold.
Obviously, the government of Angola says that they believe in the independence of the Angolan judicial system. Is that something that you share?
No, there is no independence. This is a political decision. And why is it a political decision? Last week, I personally co-organized with members of civil society and the opposition a quite large gathering in support of in solidarity of this with the 17 and the victims of political intolerance. And the government fears the snowball effect. And that was the first time when civil society and the opposition met together for the same cause. That scared the government.
So you believe that the motivation behind the release of these young activists by the Supreme Court is because of the recent political developments we've seen in Angola? It has nothing to do with the fact that they might be trying to relitigate or even appeal their sentences.
The president's appointment of his daughter to head the national oil company has caused a major storm in the country. So basically, this is a measure that the president has taken to tamper down the mood against him in the country. After 37 years in power, he's going to be the only candidate for his party. So basically, this is a measure to deflate the tension that has been brewing, especially with the appointment of his daughter, the coming together of opposition and civil society, and the Congress. These are the three main factors. And there's another example. Some of them have been charged with destruction of state property for writing on their uniforms as a protest, and they have to face trial for writing on their uniforms. this is a country where the government basically is a little more than a gang, and that they have been pillaging the state resources and assets, and yet they will convict these young people because they wrote on their uniforms. And the people that have squandered billions of dollars, have siphoned billions of dollars, they walk free. So from there, you can see what kind of justice we have that will persecute individuals writing critical messages on their uniforms rather than those who are causing harm to the country's economy. And those are people within the presidential circle and the president himself.
Rafael Marquez de Moraes is an Angolan journalist and human rights activist. He was speaking to me from his home in the Angolan capital, Luanda. Burundi's human rights record is under scrutiny at the United Nations Human Rights Council over the objections and anger of that country's government. The council says it is alarmed at the rise in rights violations in Burundi since last year's political crisis. It wants the violations to stop because it fears an ethnic conflict with devastating consequences for all of Central Africa. Lisa Schlein has this report.
The United Nations and the government of Burundi have polar opposite views on what is happening in the country, a year after President Pierre Nkurunziza was elected to what his critics call an unconstitutional third term. While the government accuses the UN of a campaign of distortion, UN Human Rights Chief Zeid Ra'ad Al Hussein expresses great concern over the terrible reality that is playing out. In a report submitted to the UN Human Rights Council, Zaid accuses Burundi government agents and associated militia of killings, disappearances, and arbitrary arrests. He says he is alarmed at the prospect of an escalation in ethnic violence.
In the past 6 weeks, a number of members of the defunct Armed Forces of Burundi, or ex-FAB, have been murdered, possibly because of their Tutsi ethnicity. In the south of the country, I've also been informed of speeches by members of the Imbonerakure amounting to incitement to violence against political opponents with strong ethnic overtones.
Given Burundi's history of conflict between Hutus and Tutsis, the High Commissioner warns the acts of incitement are potentially explosive. Willie Niyamitwe, a senior advisor to the president of Burundi, rejects accusations that the Imbonerakure, the ruling party's youth wing, is spreading hate speech and attacking people. He tells VOA the group is not a militia.
They don't have weapons. They are not killing people. But you can see when you go through these reports that even the High Commissioner is saying it's a militia that is intimidating people, killing citizens, but without giving evidences. We need facts. So when there's no facts, these are flying rumors.
Niyamitwe accuses Rwanda and Belgium of trying to destabilize Burundi by manipulating organizations such as the International Crisis Group and Human Rights Watch.
Some reports are really biased, and it's a campaign, a huge campaign of distortion and fabrication and lies that have been spread over the internet. Burundi is not the first country in Africa that has been destabilized by some powers that are working hardly for a regime change. Everything that has been said about mass killings, about genocide against Tutsis, were wrong.
The High Commissioner spokeswoman, Cecile Puyi, agrees that genocide is a very specific and powerful term that should not be used lightly. However, she disagrees with Niyamitwe's contention that the High Commissioner's report is not based on fact. She tells VOA that UN human rights monitors are in contact with a large network of people. She says they carefully document all the information they receive.
What we observe is the number of extrajudicial executions going down. At the same time, we see a number of human rights violations going up, other trends, including number of arbitrary arrests, arbitrary detentions, and very worrying increase in the use of torture and ill treatment, especially in detention facilities run by the Service National de Renseignement Intelligence Agency, if you want, the police and the army.
Puyi says grenade attacks against the police and army are increasing. People continue to be displaced within the country and as refugees in neighboring countries.
And the crisis that is going on right now in Burundi has been ongoing for months right now, is affecting the whole region. And the High Commissioner has on many occasions warned against the risk of destabilization for the entire region.
The International Criminal Court recently said it will open a preliminary examination into violence in Burundi. UN Rights Chief Zaid welcomes that. He is urging the authorities to bring all those responsible for crimes to justice and for the country to resolve its crisis through an inclusive national dialogue. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And now it's time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here's Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Jackson. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with football. Hosts Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa edged Nigeria's Enyimba 2-1 in the capital, Tshwane, as Morocco's Wydad Casablanca outwitted the visiting ZESCO United of Zambia 2-0 in Rabat in mini-league action in the Orange Africa Champions League matches on Wednesday night. After the second round of matches, Wydad Casablanca lead Group A with 6 points. ZESCO United and Ivory Coast's ASEC Mimosa have 3 points each, while Egypt's El Ahly have no point. Mamelodi Sundowns and Egypt's Zamalek top Group B with 3 points each. Enyimba has no point, while Algeria's Entente TIFF has been disqualified from the competition. Meanwhile, Ghana's Medeama and Algerian visitors Mouloudia Bejaia played to a scoreless draw in mini-league phase of the Orange Africa Confederations Cup in Sekondi, some 30 kilometers east of the Ghanaian capital, Accra, on Wednesday night, while Tunisian defending champions the Etoile du Sahel played to a 1-1 draw with visitors FUS Rabat of Morocco in Sousse. Consequently, after the second round of matches, the Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe lead in Group A with 6 points. Mouloudia Bejaia has 4, Medeama 1, and Tanzania's Young Africans have no point. Morocco's Kaukab Marrakesh and FUS Rabat lead Group B with 6 points and 4 points respectively. Etoile du Sahel has 1 point, while Libya's El Ahly Tripoli has 1 point. In Olympic news, South Africa is drawn in Group B with Australia, France and Spain in the preliminaries of the men's 7-a-side rugby contest at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. According to the draws conducted in Rio de Janeiro on Wednesday, Kenya are in Group C with Britain, Japan, and New Zealand. Meanwhile, Kenya are the only Africans in the women's contest where they are drawn in Group B with France, Spain, and New Zealand. In basketball, Tunisia play the Czech Republic in the second friendly match in Turin, Italy, today, Thursday. The Czechs beat Tunisia 78-74 in the first match on Tuesday. Tunisia is preparing for the qualifying contest for the men's Olympic basketball event, which takes place in Turin, Italy, next week. And that's it for the Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Etegwini, South Africa. Back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark, and have a good day. And that's it for this Thursday, June 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters James Batty, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all, on VOA Africa.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.